D News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. If you are a listener to the morning show, then you have probably figured out by now that I am a huge fan of Star Trek, the original series. And we have touched on the phenomenon of Star Trek any number of times on this program. But today is a very special thrill for me because I have the opportunity to speak with one of the cast members of Star Trek, the original series, Walter Koenig, who portrayed the role of Ensign Pavel Chekhov, both in the original series and in the series of major motion pictures that were made beginning in 1979. Walter Koenig, in addition to being a gifted actor, is also a gifted writer, with a number of books to his credit. The most recent is a memoir called Beaming Up and Getting Off, Life Before and Beyond Star Trek, a disarmingly honest and illuminating look at his life and his career. The book is published by Jacobs Brown Press. I want to ask you first about something that's really lovely said in the foreword of the book by J. Michael Straczynski, who is the creator of the celebrated series Babylon 5, in which you enjoyed a recurring guest role that you count among your happiest experiences professionally and one of your best accomplishments as an actor. Mr. Straczynski, in the foreword to your book, says, "You will find this book refreshingly absent of agendas, political or personal." I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about that absence of agendas, and if that was something that you were really consciously careful of, or did you just kind of write the book, and did it just end up being without any of those kind of agendas that sometimes appear in similar books?
Well, my feeling is, if you're going to write about people you don't like and you're going to say what it is about them you don't like, they should be there to rebut your accusations or your statements. I just don't think it's fair to harangue people and then not have an opportunity to counter what you're saying. So for the most part, not entirely. There are a few people that I do chastise to some degree, but for the most part, I didn't feel I had to do that. I just wanted to tell my story and hope that people would find it entertaining and insightful. And it just felt good to put it all down on paper. I was approached to do this, and as were the other actors. And the invitation was just too delicious to not go forward with it. So I had a good time writing it.
Absolutely. And I want to add that even though it is, and again, to quote Mr. Straczynski, absent of agendas, political or personal, that doesn't make it a tame or tepid book. This is a book that's very vividly drawn and very, very powerful. And there is a lot to digest here, and I appreciate that. One of the things that I especially appreciated about your book is that I learned so much about your professional career as an actor before you became Mr. Chekhov on Star Trek. And you recount all of the different guest roles you had on The Untouchables, Combat, Mr. Novak, The Lieutenant, Gidget, the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, and so on. But part of the story of those years of trying to really hit it big as an actor, as a professional actor, are all the frustrations and all the broken promises. At one point, you write this: more often than not, what an actor's career is about are promises that are lighter than air, because we are so willing and adept as performers at taking a fantasy and creating a reality from it, we lose sight of where reality ends and the fantasy begins in our own lives. We suspend disbelief when we act the way a child does when he uses his fingers for a six shooter. In the same way, we have a childhood's faith in the truth of what we have been told, even when over and over again we are either misled or encouraged to imagine that there is more than meets the eye. Your career, as the career of so many, is littered with all kinds of broken promises. Why do you think that is such a predominant facet of this world of which you've been a part? And over the years, did it become easier to sort of endure that unhappy part of it?
Well, I can answer the last part better. Yeah, it's become easier over the years. You know, when I was in the first 10, 15 years of my career, everything was sort of life and death, every audition I went to. And I was significantly pained by disappointment and disillusionment when I wasn't accepted for a role. I've become a little more philosophical since then, and I think that's part of the survival mechanism. I think, you know, genetically, and I do think it's genetic, over time, you either adapt or you die, you know, you go nuts. You have to get to a point where you can say, okay, it didn't happen, I didn't do well, it's not the end of the world, there'll be another opportunity, and I'll try again. And I think we all need to do that. We all need to be able to endure disappointment and failure, and pick ourselves up and go forward. Either that, or you just quit. You say, that's it. My psyche can't handle this, and I'm going to do something else. I couldn't think of anything else to do. This was pretty much it. And there were the minor successes, the roles that I did win, the successes that I had that I was able to draw on to say, you know, it's not all a failure, it's not all for nothing. You know, I have done things that I've been proud of, and if I've done them in the past, surely there'll be an opportunity to do them again. So, yeah, that's pretty much how I comported myself. That's pretty much how I dealt with life. I mean, I tell a lot of stories that are meant to be bittersweet, you know, stories where I didn't get roles, but there really was a comic element to the situation. It wasn't always beating my breast and saying, poor me. It was being able to accept the absurdity of how things went, and being able to recount them to other people. Yeah, you just got to keep going, you know. And I'm certainly not unique in that regard. Most actors who have stayed with it do so because they feel that ultimately they will have some kind of success, if not, you know, in a monetary or popularity or fame or whatever, but personally, just personally feeling that that was right, that I'm glad I did that. Nobody saw it. Nobody was there. You know, it was a small theater, 30, 40 people, but I achieved something, and I can pat myself on the back.
Hmm. One of the things, of course, that's interesting, too, is that over the years you have generated really interesting projects for yourself, and you even, in your book, tell us about such a project that you generated in 1967, just ahead of getting the role of Chekhov on Star Trek, namely writing a script for a movie that you helped to create called I Wish I May. On a budget of $24,000, this movie ended up being made, in which you and your wife co-starred. And you call it one of the undertakings of my life for which I am most proud. I just think that's really interesting that already at that relatively early date, you were already beginning to kind of test your wings as a writer, not content to be simply an actor as well. What did it feel like to be kind of branching out into this new area?
Well, you know, it was one of those situations where necessity is the mother of invention. Is that the way it goes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't being called in for roles. It was a particularly dry period, and I felt that that I had to take things in my own hands. I had to create something and not wait for somebody to call me. They weren't calling me, and I felt that I needed to take a more active role in my own destiny. And it's something that I've done over the years. Although I've never thought of myself as a producer or anything really until I was at least 10 years into being an actor before I ever considered that I would write something. But the need to work, the need to be creative, the need to exercise that talent that I had was very strong. The way it is with everybody who is an artist of sorts, you need to do what you're capable of doing, what you have a love for. So, I wrote that, and Judy, my wife, played the female lead, and Gus Trakonis, who eventually married Goldie Hawn, was the other actor in the piece. So the three, it was really a bit about the three of us, the young actors trying to get work in Hollywood. It was very close to my heart, since that was exactly what we were going through. And the reason why I was so proud of it is because we finished it. We did it. We did the whole thing. It's not like you start something and then you lose the financing or you lose the enthusiasm or people tell you it's no good or whatever. We just pursued it. We just decided we were going to do it and get it done and get it made. I found the band that provided the original music. And so it was a really good feeling to have succeeded to the point where we had a finished project. Mm. Was it any good? Well, I think there were places that were good. With such a low budget, we did have a problem achieving everything we wanted. I did have a couple of screenings. One was terrible, and one was mediocre. But I was able to come away from that. We didn't sell it, but I was able to come away from that feeling good, feeling that we were movie makers.
And it was yours.
Exactly.
Well, it is time for us to talk about this little show called Star Trek, which comes along as you are working on this.
Come again? What show is that?
Right, yeah, it's just a vague part of your memory, I'm sure. One of the things that's really interesting is, as you're talking about your early career as an actor, that so often it is the people we meet that end up opening doors. So the fact that you were directed by someone for the Alfred Hitchcock Hour and met Gene Roddenberry through The Lieutenant, and were cast in Mr. Novak by Joe D'Agosta, and all three of them figured very centrally in you ultimately being cast on this science fiction show called Star Trek. But what I want you to tell our listeners about is the great story you tell about one Fred Phillips. If someone is a real Star Trek fan, they know who Fred Phillips was on that show. But especially for the sake of our listeners who don't know who Fred Phillips is, explain who he was and the big difference he made on that very first day when you came in for Star Trek.
Well, okay, now I was 31 at the time, and Fred Phillips was the makeup man, the head makeup man, and he'd been in the business for 100 years, and he was a delightful guy with a million stories, and I told him, Fred, you've got to write your autobiography. He says, no, I can't do that. I would be revealing too many personal things that happened to other people. And I don't feel I can do that. But it was delightful. I mean, his stories were delightful, and the people he worked with was delightful. When I went in, well, I was already cast. That was a bizarre story. There was only one other actor who was up for the role. I mean, when you consider what an extraordinary life Star Trek has had, and how many shows it has generated, how many different shows, that to be involved in it, at least, as you said, on the television series and seven movies, and be one of only two actors who are being considered for the role, is really, it's one of those extraordinary things that happen. I don't think the producers and the other staff members had any idea of the significance of the series and how it would go, how it would endure, and be the source of so many other Star Trek shows. But Fred looked at the back of my head and said, "Your hair is thinning. We've got to do something about that." So he brought out, I think this is what you're referring to.
Yep.
He brought out a can of something called Nestle's Streaks and Tips or something. I mean, it was a spray, and he sprayed the back of my head where the hair was thinning to make it, and it kind of thickened the hair and made it look like I had more than I actually did. And so when we started working on the show, I had an artificial hairline that was good because I was supposed to be 22 years old on the series. We also, prior to using that, we went up to, as soon as I was cast, we went up to Max Factor, which was a place where they had a lot of women's wigs and a lot of makeup and things that people used, even in, certainly on the screen, but also in real life. And we brought back four or five different colored wigs, blonde and redhead and brunette and et cetera. And I'm jumping ahead. The reason why we did that was not because my hair was thinning, because by then I had already had the hair sprayed, but because my hair was short, and they wanted a longer style hair like the monkeys, and so I tried on all these different wigs. They even had me try on a blonde wig, which was really ugly. It didn't go with my face at all. And I was praying they wouldn't use that. And they didn't. They used the one that was most naturally suited to my coloring and et cetera.
Right. So
for the first 7 episodes, I wore a woman's wig.
You know, it's interesting, too. I love the line in your book where you talk about how the first 8 weeks of Star Trek were like the 8 days of Hanukkah. And I think what you're saying there is when you were hired, it was not an absolute certainty that you would be in episode after episode after episode. Maybe it was when they hired you, it was not really maybe set in stone just how significant a part of the cast or how regular a part of the cast you were going to be. And it sounds like so week after week, another script would show up and there's Mr. Chekhov again, and you started to realize that I'm really a part of this thing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I didn't sign a run-of-the-show contract or a run-of-the-season contract. I was hired on a weekly basis. Most of the actors had 7 out of 13 episodes or 11 out of 13 episodes, or every episode, like Bill and Leonard. But yeah, I was, you know, and I'd come in and I'd do a day's work and I'd be paid for the day and that was it. It wasn't for the week. But generally what happened was, if I did a couple of days and the last day of my shoot was also the last day of the episode shooting, the new episode, which would be shot the following week, would come to the soundstage and hand it out to the actors, and they kept handing me one, and so on the last day of the shooting of that episode, I found out that I was going to be in the next one, mm-hmm. and so it went, episode after episode. So it was delightful, and nobody promised me anything. Nobody said it would go on. And bear in mind, this was a couple of months before the audience ever got a look at it. Mm. But the executives saw the dailies, the shots that we had done that particular day, the day before, and felt that I fitted in with the other actors and that I was bringing something to the role that was a plus. And so they kept finding ways to use me in the script.
Right. And, of course, you recount how when actor George Takei, who played Mr. Sulu, when his time away to make the movie Green Berets stretched out into unexpectedly long absence, you ended up moving into certain episodes that had been conceived with the character of Sulu in mind. So there were a couple of things going on there that made you more and more indispensable. Couple of questions.
Yeah.
Couple of questions I want to ask, and maybe I want to start with a statement. One of the things that is kind of a theme in your book and that I appreciate is the fact that at some point the decision began to get made that Star Trek was mostly about the big three, Kirk and Spock and Dr. McCoy, and that the other members of the crew, the other regulars, at least the perception was that more and more they were shunted to the side. And we had less and less a sense of this whole crew and more about the big three going on all of the adventures and leaving the rest of you behind. And I've always felt bad not only for you and your fellow actors who weren't given more to do. I mean, in your case, you were given some wonderful episodes, but still not as much as I think your talent warranted. But it also, I think, made it a more shallow show. I think Star Trek was always at its best when it was about more than just those iconic big three characters, and I would imagine that you would very much agree with me.
Well, you know, the first year, I just felt lucky to be working, you know, and I didn't even think about whether I was contributing sufficiently to the, you know, to the show's success. I was just happy to be on the set and say my Warp Factor 3 captain line and go home. As time went on, however, I began to feel, yeah, I can do more than what I'm doing. I don't have to feel like I am just so grateful for the opportunity that I don't have to recognize that my work was really very limited. And so I, you know, the more comfortable I became, the more I wanted to really contribute to the show. I didn't feel that I was doing that. And that was also the case with George and Michelle, and to some extent with Jimmy doing as well. And then when we started going to conventions, and we would come out on the stage, and literally, I'm not exaggerating, this is not hyperbole, the crowds would stand up and applaud our entrance and be so enthusiastic about us as well as the three that you mentioned. We began to feel even more that we would certainly, if not indispensable, we could certainly add to the overall success of the show if we were given the opportunity. So yeah, that happened. That absolutely did happen. You know, before we knew what the audience was thinking, when we were just shooting the episodes and they hadn't been on the air yet, it was just a sense of, well, we have jobs, we some place to go every week, we're getting paid, and how nice that is. Hmm. But then you know, your ego gets involved, and you say, well, if people out there are so enthusiastic about our appearances on the series, then yeah, why not? Why not have more to do?
Hmm. I think one thing I want to say too is I remember, as you know, when I first watched this show as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, I found it completely believable and plausible. I mean, it felt like we were peering into an actual ship traveling through space, and you guys were really the crew of the USS Enterprise, and what you were doing felt absolutely real. I never felt like I was watching a bunch of actors, even though on some level I knew that's what I was doing. But I mean, it was done to such a high level, I mean, within the constraints of the technology and special effects of the day. But I feel like you and George Takei, for instance, and Nichelle Nichols, when you were sitting at those consoles and pressing those buttons, to this day when I watch that, I feel like you're doing that, and you're Mr. Chekhov and he's Mr. Sulu, and when you press that button, you really are firing the photon torpedoes. I mean, in a way that when I watch even the Star Trek series that have come after it, I never feel like those actors are as convincing as you guys were. I mean, it wasn't Hamlet or Macbeth, but on the other hand, it was a challenge in and of itself that I think you and your castmates met beautifully.
Well, you know, first of all, if you were 10 or 11, you'd be more likely to accept the reality of what we were doing than if you were older and a little bit more cynical or a little bit more aware of the process. But, and I add this with full cognizance, it's an actor's responsibility to make it as real as you can, and to believe it yourself. And I think that's what we all try to do. I think you have to absorb the experience and the reality of it, because if you don't believe it, the audience isn't going to believe it. So we came to it with the sense that this was all happening, and there was peril, and there were moments when we were very involved in the situation at hand, and I think that's the way you have to approach every role you play. If I was playing a vampire, I would approach it the same way. I would approach it with, boy, do I love that blood. I mean, that's, when people say to me, how is it you played Mr. Bester, and he was so different than Chekhov? Well, that's an actor's responsibility. Those are the tools that he was gifted with to make it feel as real as possible. And when they say you were a bad guy on Babylon 5, I never felt like I was a bad guy. I always felt that I could justify what I did. I did it for my people, for the telepaths, and it was important that that I support them and keep them out of harm's way. And for the time that I was on this stage, I always had that attitude. I mean, the perfect example of that, and I say the quintessentially perfect example of that is Mr. Spock. Leonard was always Mr. Spock. In the dressing room, in the hallway, at lunch, he was Mr. Spock, and he never let go of it. And in fact, it was problematic in his family life, because he took it home with him. And that's why I've always said there are 100 actors for each of our roles in Hollywood who could have been as convincing as our characters, but there was only one person who could play Mr. Spock as convincingly as Leonard, and that was Leonard, because he maintained that character and that aura and those feelings all the time. I never got to know Leonard. I never got to know him until we were like in the third or fourth movie. Because the only being that I was in contact with was Mr. Spock, and I think that's why he was so good, because he just maintained that character all the time.
Hmm. I mentioned earlier that I've had the pleasure of interviewing author Mark Cushman on several occasions about his books. These Are the Voyages, and his latest series of books explore that important decade of the 1970s, which is right after Star Trek, the original series, goes off the air in 1969. And it is in the 1970s that, in a sense, the real phenomenon is born, with syndication, with those conventions, the revival of interest with the animated series, and, of course, then ultimately these big, big films. How astonished were you at what sort of overtook Star Trek during the 1970s? Did you have any inkling that it was going to become what it became?
No. And I can say categorically, neither did anybody else. When Gene Roddenberry called us in the spring of 1969 and said, "Well, it's been great, guys. I've thoroughly enjoyed working with you all, and maybe we'll meet up again in the future." That, he had somewhat of a tenor voice. That's what I'm working for here. And I said, "Well, nice working with you, Gene." And we hung up the phone, and I literally thought, "Well, I'll probably never see him again." And that was the attitude that we all had. It was over. It was fini. It was done. It was not it was not going to be a part of my life anymore. And what do I do now? And actually, for the first couple of years in the 70s, I was out of work. I got work as a writer, but I didn't get any work as an actor. I didn't get called in to work. I was persona non grata, or so it seemed. And then we started hearing, we may be coming back. And really, really? And then it didn't happen. And you'd say, well, okay. And then we heard, we may be coming back. And this time it was, yeah, right. You know, and that happened literally two or three times. And after a while, you become inured to that prospect. And you say, well, it's just talk. So it was a very gradual situation where we were told we might come back, and then we didn't. And you begin to think that it's just going to be talk. And then when they said, come in for a costume fitting, then you allowed yourself a little bit to have some hope that this was going to happen. And my hand to God, I went in, they measured me, they said, Walter, you know, we can use the same costumes. Your body weight is the same. You haven't changed. That's just great. And Greg got home, walked in the door, the phone rang, hello, we're postponing Star Trek. And it was just like that, from being, yes, you know, the costume fits, we're going forward, to getting home and being told that we're postponing Star Trek. So, and that happened, I wrote the foreword to one of Mark's books, and I cited the game that we used to play.
Oh, yes, Green Light, Red Light.
Yeah.
I remember. I remember that forward vividly, yes. And that's speaking to this, like, it's a go, it's not a go, it's a go, it's not a go, this experience
right.
that you
right.
and your castmates had through these years.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it went, and we were going to make a small movie. We were going to make a TV series, then we were going to make a low-budget movie, and then when Star Wars became so successful, I've been told that this is absolutely true, I've been told by people who were in position to know. When Star Wars became so successful, some of the executives at Star Trek looked at each other and said, the executives at Paramount looked at each other and said, what do we have that we could make into a science fiction movie? And somebody said, well, we do have Star Trek. And it went from there. You know, 1979 came along, and we had this big big breakfast at the studio with at least 100 people from the media, photographers, writers, publicists, all there. And they had built a bridge, and we were all sitting at our positions at the bridge, George at the helm, me at the navigator's position, Jimmy off at the engineer's, Michelle at the communications center, and Bill came on and was sitting in the captain's chair and then got up and made a little speech about how we're going to make the Star Trek movie, and he went about, and this is an aside, this isn't really part of the story, but I love to tell it. He stepped off the bridge and went to each of our stations and said, and this is Jimmy Doohan, who's going to play Engineer Scotty, and this is DeForest Kelly, who's Dr. McCoy, and Leonard Nimoy, who's Mr. Spock, and Nichelle Nichols, who's Uhura, and this is George Takei, who's playing Mr. Sulu, and this is and this is Mr. Chekhov. He didn't remember my name.
that's the kind of moment that nobody would be able to forget. You don't just have to have Walter Koenig's special memory for life's painful moments. I think most people would not allow that very easily to slip from memory.
I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
I thought it was hilarious. And, of course, that became a theme in our relationship. We didn't have much of a relationship. And that's a whole different story. And you can get corroboration from that, if Jimmy was still here, from Jimmy and George and Michelle, because that was a continuing situation. But let's not talk about that.
Actually, let's say something positive. One thing I appreciate in your book is that you have very warm words of praise for DeForest Kelly, who played Dr. McCoy. And one of the things you say about him, which I don't remember seeing or reading anyplace else, is that he was somebody that was, in a sense, someone who very easily and naturally pivoted between the big three of which he was a part. In other words, he could be very close with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, Kirk and Spock, but that he could turn right around and be equally close and friendly and respectful to you and George Takei and Nichelle Nichols and so on. I thought that was a really sweet compliment that you paid him.
Well, it's true. It was absolutely true. He was a very warm, fun guy, told stories. He'd been in the business a long time, too. When we were waiting for, you know, news of a new Star Trek, is it coming or is it not, all through that period of the 70s and 80s, we'd call each other up and talk about it and commiserate or, you know, find the things that had happened on the set funny and joked about. Yeah, he was a great guy. Everybody loved DeForest. With great sadness that we learned of his passing.
Do you have time for just a couple more questions?
Sure.
I'm speaking with Walter Koenig. We're talking about his wonderful book, Beaming Up and Getting Off: Life Before and Beyond Star Trek. One thing that I think is a really sad moment in the book regarding Star Trek is a special memo or an excerpt from a memo that you print. And this is something that Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, had sent to a couple of, I believe, NBC executives in projecting what might potentially occur in the fourth season, which, of course, never happened. But one of the elements of that memo is where he outlines his hopes for the character of Pavel Chekhov, your character. And you tell us that he spends as much time talking about what will happen to Chekhov as he did talking about what would happen to, for instance, Mr. Spock. And I don't know if you knew about that at the time or only much later, but it's just really sad to think about, in a sense, the unrealized potential when there ended up not being a fourth season in which your character events in Chekhov might have really played a really interesting and pivotal part.
Yeah, I did know about that. In fact, Gene invited me to his house, and it was during the third season, and he showed me those memos, and they were the two guys named Schlosser and Werner, who were NBC execs. And in the memo, it said, let's incorporate the actor who plays Chekhov more into the story. Let's have him go down to the planet and get involved and have some relationships with young ladies. The fans seem to enjoy that. The letters were... There was a focus in many of the letters about Chekhov being more appealing a character, and that's of course why they brought me on in the first place. They were citing Davy Jones from the Monkees, you know, and we need some, we would like Chekhov to be something, someone like that, where there's a lot of appeal. And it was really kind of ironic because I was already 31 when I started as Chekhov. Chekhov was supposed to be 22, and I had all these prepubescent girls, you know, 9 and 10-year-olds, thinking that I was 22 and writing that I was groovy and, you know, and that they really enjoyed the character. And they loved his hair, which half the time was a woman's wig. But so it was all going to be much more involving for my character. And I remember the moment, the absolute moment, that I knew it wasn't going to happen. Jimmy, George, and I were doing a photo layout for a teenage magazine, and what would be more appealing to little girls than Star Trek characters and horses? So our layout was riding horses, and I was sitting atop a horse, and somebody came on the set, or came on the place. It wasn't a set. We were at a ranch, and I said, "Did you hear the news? You guys are being switched from Monday at 7:30 to Friday at 10. And at that moment, I knew all those ideas and about Chekhov and how he would be used in the next season were not going to happen, because my audience were those little kids, and at 7:30 and 8 o'clock, they were home, and they were still awake. At 10 o'clock, they were either in bed and asleep or out at the local soda fountain. You know, they weren't there. And so I knew that my audience was not going to be there in the supportive way they had. I just knew it. I absolutely knew that. And the first episode that reflected the other way of thinking was Spectre of the Gun, where Chekhov goes down to the planet, where he has a scene with a girl, and there's a little romance going on, and then he gets shot. And those are all big things to happen. They are not just standing around and looking at my tricorder to see if there are any woolly mammoths around, you know. They were special moments for the character, and that's the way all the episodes were supposed to go, and of course they didn't. I was back to Warp Factor 4 again, so yeah, that was disappointing, and it told us that a fourth season was not going to happen. That it was not only because Chekhov had less to do, but because the producers, people in charge, and the network, mostly the network, had pretty much given up on us.
Well, fortunately, the world didn't give up on Star Trek, and in fact, Star Trek would go on to become an even bigger phenomenon than it was before. And your career after Star Trek also included a marvelous run on the acclaimed science fiction series Babylon 5. You chronicle all that and more in your wonderful book called Beaming Up and Getting Off, Life Before and Beyond Star Trek, published by Jacobs Brown Press, the author, Walter Koenig. Walter Koenig, it's been a great pleasure and honor for me to speak with you today. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the time. That's very kind of you. I've had a good time. Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor at Carthage College, pays his monthly visit to the program, offering his thoughts on various issues and concerns. On Thursday, Brian Stile and Roger Pollack contending for the U.S. Congressional seat for the 1st District. You'll hear them in separate interviews on Thursday. On Friday, Holly Stanfield from Kenosha Unified talks about how the school district's moving forward with some of its theatrical and musical theater productions. And we'll hear from Jim Schatzman in the Choral Arts Society as well. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information on all that Carthage offers is available at carthage.edu.